He has published 6 books and numerous journal articles. He has a forthcoming edited book called China Engages Latin America, Tracing the Trajectory. Because of his experience and knowledge, Dr. Leon Manriquez has been asked to give lectures all over Asia and Latin America, so we are very happy we can have him here today. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Jose Luis Leon Manriquez.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's my pleasure to be here with you at the Korean Economic Institute in Washington, D.C. Thank Nicholas Hamisevich for your kind words. Thank Ambassador Jack Pritchard for being here. As Nicholas said, I'm going to talk about the economic reforms in North Korea and Cuba. Probably North Korea and Cuba are two of the most exotic countries in the world in terms of economic organization. Both of them still stick to the idea of having a command economy, a central planned economy. But anyhow, they have had to make economic reforms in order to promote regime survival. So I will make this comparison of both countries. As we will see in some graph, Cuba has had a better performance than North Korea in economic terms in the 1990s. And my thesis is that this difference in economic performance has a lot to do with a continuity in Cuban policies to attract foreign direct investment, especially in the tourist sector. This is the outline of my presentation. First of all, I will talk about some indicators of economic crisis in North Korea and Cuba. Secondly, I will address some market reforms, the intentions, the implementation, and the outcomes. And finally, I will offer a brief glance to the future and draft some scenarios for economic reforms in both countries. Before going to that, I have to make a methodological caveat. Doing this kind of comparative work in economics sometimes is very difficult because one has to make economic archaeology. North Korea stopped working economic data in 1984, at the very same time that South Korea was surpassing, in economic terms, North Korea. And in the case of Cuba, there is a different methodology to calculate GDP. Cubans used to call it Producto Social Bruto, which means social gross product, something like that, which is different from GDP. However, the Economic Commissions for Latin America and the Caribbean, CEPAL in Spanish, has made some very good work in trying to convert those previous Cuban calculations into Western-style calculations of GDP. So most of the data here come from ECLAC, precisely, and for North Korea come from the indirect estimations of the Bank of South Korea. There have been some criticism to these South Korean estimations of North Korean GDP. Some scholars think that these calculations underestimate the real growth of South Korean problem, but those are the only ones we have, at least comprehensive ones. Let me begin with a brief comparison of both economies. As you can see in this table, GDP in Cuba is much bigger than North Korea, 5 times bigger. It raises to $60 billion per year. Population is half in Cuba, only 11 million people against 24 million people in North Korea. And geographic area is pretty much the same. It's 110 square kilometers in the case of Cuba, 120 in the case of North Korea, which is about the same size of the state of Pennsylvania here in the United States. This is the evolution of GDP per capita in North Korea and Cuba. As you can see here, Cuba underwent a sharp decline in GDP in the early 1990s. It used to have about 3,000, and so it reached about 2,000. But after that, Cuba had first a slow recovery and then quicker recovery. In turn, you can see this in this part, North Korean GDP per capita is basically stagnant since 1990s. In $1,000, which is comparable to many African countries. In this graph, I made a comparison of GDP percentage growth in Cuba and North Korea. We see here that, especially in the 2000, Cuba has had more successful economic performance, in some cases reaching in 2005 to 2006 two-digit rates, while North Korea has performances closest to 0% or even negative in 2006 to 2008. So let me talk a little bit about the crisis in North Korea. The official discourse of this crisis was that it was due to the collapse of the Soviet bloc, to the external aggression, and to climate problems that there were in North Korea, droughts, and then bad agriculture performance. But in this interpretation, the crisis was just temporary. It was not due to the nature of the model, of the economic model, but it was due to external factors alien to the political regime. But there is still another view, which is revisionist view, and I am part of, I subscribe that view, that the crisis is due to the shortcomings of the centrally planned economy, and then it's a structural crisis. Why do I argue this? I argue this because many of the North Korean economic plans were unfulfilled, like in 1978 to 1984, and the plan also, the emergency plan of 1984, 1986, and the 1987, 1993 economic plans were not fulfilled. And even before, in 1988, North Korea had declared default in its foreign debt, which by then rose $20 billion. So I my argument is that the crisis proceeded took place before the fall of the Berlin Wall in both Cuba and North Korea. This is the evolution of GDP in some specific sectors in North Korea. This one is agriculture, which was one of the most affected, and it's one of the most oscillating sectors. But at the same time, you in this pink area, you can see the performance of industry. I mean, the argument of North Koreans is that crisis came from the agricultural sector. But we can see here that industrial sector had an even worse performance than agriculture. So that dismisses very much the argument that crisis came from the primary sector. As probably all of you know, these problems in agricultural sector meant a collapse, a cereal gap, the price of a famine in the late 1990s. But the industrialization was deeper than the problems in the primary sector. For instance, by 2009, the size of industry is still half of what it used to be in 1989, which means a virtual collapse of industry in South Korea. And services, especially public services, feature low productivity, while there is an increasing external gap, which is usually covered by Chinese aid or South Korean aid. Well, this is the main, just to illustrate the crisis in infrastructure, this is the main road between Wonsan and Hamgung, the main industrial city in South Korea. It's virtually destroyed. This is a photograph that was taken in a recent tour with some people present here. We had to work very hard to try to make the bus moving forward because it got stuck on the road. But it's not a secondary road. It's one of the main roads of the country. This is our North Korean guide directing a North American friend and then some Europeans. So probably it's every North Korean's dream to have Western people serving them. Okay, let me address a little bit the case of Cuba. Cuba had a similar crisis than North Korea, but the peak of the crisis was not in the second half of the 90s, but in the first half of the 90s, especially 1990 to 1993, which is a period that is known in Cuba's periodo especial en tiempos de paz, which means a special period in peacetime. It's an analogy with war. The discourse of Cuban rulers is similar to that of North Koreans. They blame the Soviet collapse. They blame hurricanes, which certainly lash Cuba very frequently. They blame the U.S. blockade and the enactment of Helms-Burton legislation, which tightened the U.S. blockade against Cuba. But anyhow, as in the case of North Korea, there was a decreasing growth and low productivity even since the 1980s. And Cuba declared a default on its external debt in 1982. But this is the evolution of GDP in specific sectors in Cuba. I want you to fix your attention in this green bar, which is trade, restaurants, and hotels. As you can see, this has been the leading sector in Cuban economic recovery, while agriculture and industry is frankly still backwards. The problem with agriculture is that it's a very bureaucratized agriculture. In the 1990s, part of the reform was to create agricultural cooperatives, but the Cuban government is very concerned of not creating too much social inequality. So there were some state-owned enterprise in the agriculture, and there were these cooperatives. So what obviously these cooperatives were much more productive than public enterprise in agriculture. But what was happening is that there was a gap between in the incomes and productivity of these cooperatives and these state-owned enterprises. So what the government did was to create a monopsony, which is the only one that can buy agricultural stuff to cooperatives. And so they sometimes this monopsony fixes prices below production cost. And so that's a way to equalize the income of people who belong to the states and people who belong to these cooperatives. And the other feature of Cuban economy, this is a major change, is the collapse of sugar industry. Up to the late 1980s, Cuban economy was mostly based in the export and transformation of sugar. But this industry has collapsed. Probably you remind that in 1970, there was a campaign which was called the 10 million tons harvest of sugar, SAFRA. But now, if you compare what Cubans were expecting from sugar harvest with what they get today, this time, they only get 1 million tons. So it means that sugar production is now 10% of what it used to be in the 1970s. In a parallel process with this deindustrialization, there is a boom in the services in Cuba. Not only in tourism, which has become the main Cuba export, but increasingly in the export of professional services to Venezuela. Fortunately for Cuba, to some extent, they have a new partner, President Hugo Chavez from Venezuela, and he's very generous. For instance, he sell oil in Cuba $25 per barrel when it's more than 100 in the international market. And by Hugo Chavez has bought a lot of professional service, especially medicine, nurses, to Cuba and people in the health sector, and Venezuela pays very well for this for these services. Anyhow, in the external sector there is still a gap. This unproductive agriculture makes Cuba to import lots of food stuff. 50% of lands in Cuba are unproductive because nobody wants to work on them because of low productivity. And they also have to import a lot of industrial inputs. However, what one has to say is that over this special period, Cuba maintained a very active social policy in terms of health, which is very developed in relative terms in Cuba, and also in terms of education. Whenever there is a measurement of education achievements in Latin America, Cuba is always at the very first place. And mathematics, language, skills, whatever, Cuba comes always in the first time. And by the way, this is one of the most marketed achievements by the Cuban government. Okay, let me go to the second part of my presentation, which has to do with some common features in the market reforms in North Korea and Cuba. The first common feature is that both countries started reforms in the early 1990s. It was more unlike China, that started its reforms in 1988, foreseeing changes in the international system and foreseeing the necessity to implement some market measures. In the case of both Cuba and North Korea, the changes were forced, were not almost involuntary. They changed because they had to change, otherwise they would have disappeared. But these changes were the strictly changed to maintain a bare minimum survival changes. So it was piecemeal changes. And both countries, North Korea and Cuba, fear the rise of new social classes, let's call it a bourgeoisie, that could become independent of the state and then ask for increasing shares of political and economic power. Probably this is the most important fear in both North Korean and Cuban elites. Thus, in both countries, the reforms have followed a stop-and-go pattern. At some moment, it seems that reforms will proceed very fastly, but then they are stopped or even reversed, and then start again. So I call it a pattern, paraphrasing Lenin, of one step forward and two steps backward. In the case of North Korea, I would say that this pattern is one step forward, two step backward. North Korea started its reforms, creating a special economic zones following the Chinese pattern in the area of Rajin Sombong in 1991. Rajin Sombong is in the border with Russia and China. And later in 2000, North Korea created a K-Song special economic zone in the border with South Korea. Later, also in the 1998, North Korea promoted the creation of the special economic zone, a touristic one in Mount Kumgang, with money from Hyundai Asan, which is a touristic branch of South Korean chaebol Hyundai. And also there was a bloom of informal markets with the famine crisis in the late 90s. The public distribution system virtually collapsed, and then there were lots of small entrepreneurs that began selling foods, especially, even if it was not completely legal, but the government tolerated. And so there are some calculations that say that probably about 20% of North Korean economy is conducted by these small entrepreneurs, like probably the germs of traders, petty traders. And in order to guarantee possible joint ventures with foreign partners, there were constitutional changes in the constitution of 1998 and in the constitution of 2009, In some articles, they North Koreans speak about private property as a possibility in some specific cases. But probably the most boldest change in thus far has been the economic package in 2002, which provided liberalization of food prices, a devaluation of the won, which would be a means to promote foreign trade, a flexibilization in the administration of state-owned enterprise, and some wage increases. In North Korea, there has been an ambiguous discourse on reforms. At some points, you see discourse in the Rodong Simun, the official newspaper, or by Kim Jong-il itself, talking about the reforms as a sweet poison, and a thing that should be taken very carefully. But sometimes the very same subjects talk about the reform as the possibility of an enormous change. So I guess this shift in the discourse about economic reforms have to do with it's a balancing act by Kim Jong-il trying to mediate between the hearts of the system and the pro-reform wing of the Korean Works Party. Anyhow, this ambiguity has created a very short-lived FDI project. Probably this is the main difference between North Korea and Cuba. In the mid-1990s, there were many companies, European, Asian, Chinese, South Korean, that tried to invest in North Korea, but most of this project very soon failed. Probably one of the main examples of this is the closure of the tourist resort of Mongkunggang in 2008 because of geopolitical tensions between the two Koreas. And there have been also many problems in special economic zones. For instance, the first one, Rajin Sombong, was expecting to get almost $5 billion US dollars in foreign direct investment, but thus far it only attracted 80 million. So the most productive industry there is a casino run for Hong Kong entrepreneurs rather than any industry, any factory. And to broaden these contradictions, in November 2009, the government created a currency reform, which in actuality, I guess, it was a counter-reform in economic terms. Okay. Let me now address a little bit the case of Cuba. One of the first measures after the fall of the Soviet Union, or even before that, was for the Cuban government to change rules of the game to allow joint ventures in tourism. Cuba is such a beautiful country, is very well located, close to the United States, close to Canada, not too far from Europe, has beautiful natural sceneries. And so the Cuban government was very aware that this would be a good thing to do to promote tourism. So they introduced some constitutional changes in 1992 and by the law 77 of 1995, in which they allow some concession of private property by the state to particular business, particular firms, in some cases, in the cases which is good for Cuban economy and Cuban socialism, that's the argument. And also, as in the case of North Korea, Cuba established some special economic zones. We have to remind that the Caribbean has been very active in creating these assembling industries, like in Dominican Republic, or in Central America, or in Mexico. So Cuba had the same idea, and so tried to attract some capitals in manufacturing assembling in Cuba. And the last measure, the one in which the Cuban government has been more hesitant, is marketization. So the government promoted these cooperatives and also allowed some people to rent some rooms in their houses for foreign tourists. So I call them these proto-hotels. and also allowed the establishment of very small restaurants, usually owned by people of the Communist Party, like middle-range cadres of the Communist Party, which I'll call in Spanish paladares. As I argued before, not most, but at least half of these projects of FDI had some success. There were many joint ventures, 25 joint ventures, with between Cuban government and Spanish enterprises in the touristic sectors. Most of Spanish chains, hotel chains. Those were very successful. Spanish business brought expertise and brought marketing to Cuba. And there was also a very successful project in the exploitation of nickel in Cuba by a Canadian enterprise called Sherritt, which is still working. And very recently, Chinese companies are trying to exploit oil in Cuba, which is now we have discovered that Cuba has lots of oil resources now, in close to the Gulf of Mexico. Probably the most successful activity was tourism. In the 1990s, there were about 25,000 visitors to Cuba every year, and now there are about 2 million visitors. So I didn't have the graph, but it's pretty much like this. And it's becoming more and more expensive to go to Cuba. So Cuba is getting lots of money because of tourism. So probably this is the bright side of the reform. Let me talk about the dark side. Most of special economic zones failed by many factors. First of all, because foreign business found very difficult to deal with negotiation of salaries and incentives for Cuban workers. They had to deal directly with state, and the state usually fixed very high wages for Cuban workers. The U.S. blockade to Cuba also was an obstacle because it made very difficult to import stuff to be assembled in Cuba. In the case of the cooperatives, I already addressed the problem of this public monopsony. And in the case of small and medium enterprises, these proto-hotels and these small restaurants, the government made a reverse in 1995 because they realized that these small businesses were becoming very productive. They were getting lots of money, in relative terms, of course. And many of the owners of this business were somehow becoming independent from the political regime. So Fidel Castro said, this is enough. We have to put stop on this process of marketization. And what he did was to burden these small firms with more taxes, so that many of them went broke. And the one that survived reduced their levels of income, so that the employees of these firms basically get the same money from the employees in the public sector. There's a very funny regulation that was enacted in 1995 that no restaurant can have more than 12 chairs. More than 12 chairs. So this has the same logic of avoiding the blooming of an entrepreneurial class in Cuba. There were no major changes between 1995 and 2006. But anyhow, the economy grew acceptably well. As I said before, there were some periods of two-digit rates in 2005 and 2006. Hugo Chavez became the sort of a new Soviet Union for Cuba because of heavily subsidized oil and this payment for medical services. The rationale of this economic counter-reform was to avoid increasing social gaps. What was happening in the first moments of these economic reforms was that many young people were not attending universities. They were dropping universities because it was more fashionable for them and more profitable for them go to the tourist sector, drive a taxi, or work in a hotel than attending a university and studying a lot and then have a small return from their career. So they were preferring, there was a drop in the university attendance in 1995. And the other problem is that there were increasing social gaps because some people were getting lots of money and some people still belong to the public sector with very, very low wages. But then it came a momentum for a second wave of reforms in Cuba in by the mid-2000s. In 2006, Fidel Castro got sick and was replaced by his brother Raul in a dynastic succession. Right now, many newspapers talk about a generational change, but I don't see a generational change. Raul Castro is, Fidel Castro is 84 years old, Raul Castro is 82. So it's not, it's everything but a generational change. It's just a family, a dynastic succession. And this model, like tourism-led model, began, had problems. Cuba became very expensive for visitors because of a system of dual currency. Many hotel rooms in Cuba were empty in 2007-2008. Then there were, in 2008, there were three hurricanes that lashed Cuba. The global crisis also affected the tourism flows to Cuba. The nickel, which was becoming very productive export of Cuba, had a plummeting price, and there was a continuity of agricultural problems. And the outcome of this was a steep decline of GDP since 2006. Thus, the Cuban rulers began talking about the necessity to go again and make some economic reforms. The first measures were taken in 2008 and basically allowed Cubans to rent cars, which was forbidden before, to have cellular phones, which was forbidden before, and to have internet access in but you can access internet, but in post offices exclusively, not at home. But the most ambitious piece of reform has been the enactment of the guidelines for economic and social policies, which were issued in late 2008 and just approved last week in the sixth Congress of the Communist Party in April. I think these reforms are very ambitious. It's a very bold move by Cuban government. As I shall say later, either the Cuban system disappears, the Cuban regime collapses because of these reforms, or Cuba becomes the next China, and probably the first Latin American developed country if these reforms are successful. What are the main measures of these reforms? Well, the first of all, removing the supply booklet, which means that the state provides food and some home appliances to Cuban citizens, so this system would be replaced by private small entrepreneurs. And then the idea of leasing idle lands to cooperatives. And this another idea, which is very bold, of firing 20% of the labor force. So there is a project of firing about 1.3 million public employees in the next 3 years. The first 100,000 were fired in early March. And allowing 170 new activities in the private market, like haircuts, shoemakers, that kind of stuff. Small enterprises will be allowed to employ non-relatives, which was forbidden before. These small restaurants and hotels only could employ relatives of the owner. Now they will be able to employ non-relatives. There are some restrictions will be lifted for cooperatives. This is probably the major change, this one. Properties might be rented or sold, which means the beginning of a system of probably bounded private property, but private property anyhow. And then the gradual extinction of dual exchange policy. And with these changes, there has been also a discursive change, which moved from skepticism to urgency. By late December 2010, Fidel Castro himself said, "The Cuban model doesn't even work for us anymore." And then President Raúl Castro say, "I won't read all this paragraph, but the bottom line is, I quote, we can either rectify the situation or we will run out of time in walking on the edge of the abyss. We will sink, thus sinking the effort of entire generation. We simply must change misconception about socialism, deeply rooted for years in broad sectors of the population, as consequence of the excessive paternalistic, idealistic, and egalitarian approach that the revolution established for the sake of social justice." So this is a huge discursive change in Cuba. Okay, let me finish my presentation by providing some scenarios for North Korea and Cuba. For North Korea, I mean, there is a lot of academic work made mostly in the United States about the possible scenarios of economic reforms. I won't elaborate too much on this, but one scenario is to maintain this stasis in which North Korean economy has been stacked in the last 20 years. The second option would be to undertake some market reforms following the closed Chinese path. Indeed, Chinese are very interested in North Korea to take this path, and is pressuring for this. Another possibility has been addressed by Marcus Noland here from Washington, in which North Korea would find a third way, not in the sense of Tony Blair, but in the sense of finding a way to trade aid for security with Northeast Asian neighbors and with the United States. And the fourth scenario, which could be very linked to the first one, is that the regime could collapse, which is not altogether impossible. The scenarios for Cuba. I guess that if we have a continuum between non-reformers and reformers and central plan economies, Cuba would be closer to China or Vietnam at this moment than North Korea. North Korea is still very resilient to make any kind of economic reform. However, there are risks in Cuba. I see the risk, an impending risk, but still a risk, of a conservative backlash within the Cuban Communist Party. For instance, there were about 500,000 people that would be fired from their jobs in March, but the government only fired 100,000. So probably that delay in firing public employees is due to internal pressures within the Communist Party of Cuba. But another scenario would be that Raúl Castro lose control of economic reforms and the purported reform in Cuba becomes a kind of a frustrated perestroika, which would be closer to the Soviet scenario. Okay, let me finish with a reflection to try to make more deductive this study, a reflection of what are the best economic reforms for central planned economies. It's obvious that maintaining the model of a central planned economy doesn't work for anyone, and the case of North Korea is very telling about this. But in the other extreme, there is the transition by the Soviet Union, the transition to capitalism, which was a kind of big bang transition, very, very fast and very quick. And as a result, the Russian economy fell by 50% in the 90s, which is kind of, it's another economic collapse. So it seems to me that the best way is has been provided by China and by Vietnam, which is like a gradual transition to capitalism, which has proven to be very, very productive. Okay, so I think I have talked too much. I would have to have your input, your questions, your commentaries. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Dr. Leo Manriquez. We'll open up for questions. We have microphones, so please wait for a microphone. And if you can, please state your name and affiliation and ask a question. So start off with questions. Start right here in the front, second row.
Thanks. I'm Ken Yates of Jefferson Waterman International. In the mid-90s, I had the opportunity to share a seatmate on an Air Koryo flight into Pyongyang with a salesman from North Korea. And he was returning from Cuba, where he was selling school uniforms. He said business was terrible, but he had come through Peru and was on his way back home. But I wonder, that raises the question in my mind, what happened to the trade relationship between Cuba and North Korea? Is it alive? And if so, what's in it?
Should I answer now? Yeah. One would expect that relations between Cuba, can you hear me over there? Yeah. One would expect that trade relationship between Cuba and North Korea would be very close, but they aren't. They aren't because North Korea's foreign trade is very small, very small. Let me tell you one happened the things in Mexico, one thing that happened in Mexico. About 5 or 6 years ago, when I was watching Mexican foreign trade figures, I found that the main trade partner of North Korea was Mexico. Mexico. But what happened was that in Mexican customs, things came from, merchandises came from Korea. And so the people at customs said, what Korea, North Korea or South Korea? And so say, cross anyone. And so because of this statistical mistake, North Korea appeared as a close trade partner of Mexico. So it gives you an idea of the very small foreign trade that North Korea has with anyone. Probably it's millions of dollars at most. So Cuba is not deception. And there's also, they are not very close, even in political term. It's kind of the same rhetoric, but they are not such a good friends as one would expect. The roots of this came when in the 1970s, when there was this idea of proletarian internationalism, North Korea sent some workers to Cuba to work in the sugar harvest. And they were instructed not to have any kind of sex or relation with Cuban girls, which are beautiful, okay? But after a while, they began having homosexual relations. And Fidel Castro is quite homophobic, and he expelled them, North Koreans, from Cuba. And so since then, it looks like a joke, but it's true. I mean, since then, this relation was stressed, and so they are not so close. So I don't have concrete data about trade, but should be very, very, very small.
Okay, other questions? Yeah, right here.
Sean Leinert, George Washington University. Of the three scenarios that you mentioned, where the North Koreans maintain their command economy, enact reforms, or do the aid for security system, which, if any, do you think is most conducive to North Korea maintaining its current regime?
The third one. I would say that if North Korea manages to somehow normalize its position in the international system, it will be entitled to get some sources from Western countries, probably some indemnization from Japanese occupation during 1910 to 1945, probably some resources from the World Bank or the IMF, and the Asian Development Bank, probably increasing flows of bilateral aid from either China, South Korea, Japan, or the United States. And it's a small country anyhow. So there are some calculations that North Korea would need about $1 billion in order just to survive, and probably $2 billion in order to grow again. And that won't be too difficult to get if there is a normalization of relations between North Korea and its neighbors. I would say that it's not such a likely scenario as it was 3 or 4 years ago, but still possible. I mean, if there is a great deal of trading aid for security or trading aid for security. But that would be the most convenient scenario for the Kim family in North Korea, definitely, because it would avoid them the need to make any economic reform, and at the same time having enough resources to maintain the regime.
Okay, other questions? Right here in the middle.
Yeah, thank you. Mike Billington with Executive Intelligence Review. You described the failure of the Rajin development concepts over the past, but more recently, my sense is that there's the Chinese have reconstructed the road into Rajin. They're building a port. The Russians are either building or have built the train down into Rajin. So it appears this is moving in a more dramatic way, if you could comment on that and the whole Tumen River development idea. And in that light, has Russia re-engaged at all with Cuba? With Cuba. Have they reestablished some ties, you know, over the last 15 years or so?
Yeah, let me begin for the last question. I think Russia has become more active in Latin America, not only with Cuba, but with Venezuela. There is kind of, Russia made some military maneuvers with Venezuelan army, and is also more interested in having relations with Cuba too. So I would say yes, but not in the, I think by this time Russia doesn't have enough resources to undertake a massive involvement as, with Cuba of the sort it had in the 1970s. But anyhow, part of the reconstruction of Russian powers has to do with having presence again in Latin America with these regimes like Cuba and Venezuela. And the other question is true. I mean, as far as I know, there are some huge projects of Chinese investment in North Korea, up to 10 billion US dollars in foreign direct investment from China. Probably that could be a fourth way or a fifth way to get this money from China and then normalize the economy and stabilize it without changing political regime. It will depend very much on how much China really invests in North Korea. But from my viewpoint, South Korea probably is losing an interesting opportunity of having a foot, economic foot, in North Korea because of the President Lee Myung-bak policy of reversing sunshine policy. Also has a economic dimension, and probably that's a strategic mistake to lose the possibility of participating in the revamping of North Korean economy. But we will see. I mean, but you're right. I mean, Chinese are very, very interested, not only in investing in Rajin, but all over North Korea. But that's another dimension. I mean, Chinese are very good for promising massive FDI, and they promise 10 billion US dollars to Latin American countries, and they so far have invested 5 US billion. So let's see if they do it. Probably they will, because North Korea is closer to its strategic area.
And Russia and North Korea?
As far as I know, they don't have too much investment.
Okay, other ones right here.
Hi, Karen Lee, National Committee on North Korea. Thanks for your presentation. I'm sorry I missed the first part of it. Could you tell us a little bit about the political environment in the 1990s for people who wanted to invest in Cuba at that time, whether or not there was criticism, whether or not there was any pressure from the United States regarding organizations or countries that allowed that investment, and also whether or not workers working in the economic zones were paid directly or the government was paid and the wages were passed on. Thank you.
Yeah, they are paid by to the state. I mean, companies pay to the states, and the state obviously pay workers, but much less than probably these companies would pay employees directly.
And did they receive criticism for that? Were companies criticized for that or not?
Where? In Cuba? Or
no, outside of Cuba. For example,
Spanish companies or Mexican companies.
Yeah,
no, as far as I know, they didn't. I mean, most of these joint ventures in tourism have been done with either Spanish or Canadian or Mexican business. And they've been very, very profitable. And so most of these international chains like Meliá from Spain, et cetera, have huge investments in Cuba. They're making a lot of money. And as far as I know, they haven't been criticized. Anyhow, there was some decrease of foreign direct investment in Cuba because of the Helms-Burton Act in 1996. For instance, probably not many Spanish companies, but many Mexican companies retired investment from Cuba because they also had a trade with the United States. So they were very much concerned about losing the access to the U.S. market. And so they preferred to lose their foot in Cuba than to losing the possibility of having trade with the United States. So I would say that some companies were afraid of having consequences because of the Helms-Burton Act, but not the Spanish hotel transnationals, neither the Sherritt Company of Nickel of Canada, so they kept their. The most of the problems came from relations between these companies and the Cuban government. There was lots of red tape. Sometimes procedures were very slow. Sometimes there were new taxes, new regulations, which were not previously accorded with these companies. So many, not all of the joint ventures were successful, probably about less than half of them. But anyhow, the ones that decided to stay made it very well.
Okay, other questions? We'll go right here, and then we'll go in the back. So, right here.
Hi, Richard Shin with Economist Incorporated. My questions really relate to the political and strategic importance of North Korea and Cuba. I mean, after Soviets pulled out, Cuba was not that strategically important to the United States, whereas North Korea is still a very important state in terms of Chinese view and also from the United States and South Korea and Japan. So how did these strategic importance play a role in their economic reform? And the second question is the economic resources that each country has, they're different. I mean, North Korea is bitterly cold during the winter, and I think Cuba never gets that cold. And also, you know, North Korea has a lot of natural resources which have not been fully exploited and which are very valuable to Chinese, I think.
Yeah.
And so those are other factors that might go into how successful these economic policies have been. And then finally, the North Korea has South Korea to contend with. And the fact that they want to keep their population ignorant of the successes in South Korea, and that probably had a very strong implication in terms of what kind of policies they follow, especially economic policies. Whereas Cuba probably didn't have as much of an issue with that. And I was wondering how you would factor these things into your economic analysis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for your questions. All of them are very interesting. Let me go to the first point. I agree with you that Cuba lost geopolitical relevance after the Cold War. And perhaps for that very reason, Cuba has maintained its military expenditure constant. It hasn't grown too much. Probably that's one of the differences that explain this economic performance between the two countries, because in order to have these missiles, in order to make nuclear tests, probably North Korea has had to invest a lot of money, which is distracted from civil activities. So this geopolitical variable probably is a very good explanation of this different economic performance. I just mentioned it in the paper, but we should explore even more. The problem is that in this regard, there are no estimates, not even wrong estimates. There are no estimates. So it's very difficult to work that variable for in a study like this. But I think there's something there. North Korea has lots of natural resources. Cuba, too. I mean, Cuba has nickel and has oil, which is increasingly exploited by Chinese companies. So it's becoming an increasingly, not as Venezuela, of course, but it can produce oil. So when this oil is enough, it's more exploited, probably Cuba will reduce its dependence of energetics from abroad. But I would say that in different ways, both countries have some natural resources. And the last question was about South Korea and North Korea. I would say that some other difference between Cuba and North Korea, which I didn't address in my presentation, have to do with the grade of openness. By this time, for instance, if you want to go to Cuba, you can rent a car. You can drive by yourself. You can talk to the people. There are no more these guided tours, as in Korea, John Pioneer tours. So you can. There is a lot of visitors to Cuba, 2 million, Canadians, Europeans, some US citizens that go first to Mexico or to Canada and then go to Cuba, and their passport is not sealed. So there is a lot of contact with enemies, so to call them. And there's a lot more of information. So in comparison to North Korea, I have been to both countries, and I would say that Cuba is like a Sweden or Denmark in comparison to North Korea. You know, I was struck to find that in Havana, many households have access to cable TV from Miami, which is basically anti-Fidel Castro regime. And so they pay $10 per month to have this clandestine access to Miami TV stations. And so it's basically more open. And so they have more contact with foreign. And the other interesting difference is that there is an opposition movement within Cuba, which we don't know in North Korea. But in Cuba, there are bloggers. There are some, not political parties, but some movements against pro-human rights, whatever. So I would say that to extend, the regime has to respond to these pressures, because there is lots of involvement of European Union to defend these groups. So I would say that it's probably the reforms in Cuba also have to do with these internal and international pressures breathed by opposition within Cuba. So I think that's another variable that should be taken into account. I don't see the same, of course, in North Korea, and probably one of the main fears of the regime in North Korea is to open too much tourism and so have these floods of South Koreans or Europeans or whatever that can get information and can get films and can get Western culture to North Korea.
Okay, all the way in the back. Yes, please.
You mentioned about the transition of power in Cuba from Fidel Castro to Raul Castro. And I'm wondering if you can suggest any economic reform policy for North Korea in connection with the possible regime change from Kim Jong-il to Kim Jong-un.
Wow. I don't know. It's a very good question. I mean, Kim Jong-un is a mystery for all of us. But My guess is that it won't be easy for him, even if he has the will, because he's too young. Probably his position is very weak regarding the old guard and the harder groups of the regime. Probably he will be too dependent on military support, and military, North Korean military are frankly opposed to any economic change. So probably he would like to make some reforms, but the situation, I mean, the need to balance these opposing groups within North Korea probably will paralyze any attempt of economic reform. I don't know. I mean, I haven't read still any book by Kim Jong-un. No, probably there will many coming in next years. I don't know about his economic thought. No, there are some rumors that he attended schools in Switzerland, so in that sense could be more westernized. But anyhow, however westernized he might be, he has to balance power and interest within Korea. So I don't know, but should be very interesting to watch what happens there.
Okay, other questions? Go in the right here in the back.
Hi, Keith Krulak from State Department. What is the role of the market and of money in the Cuban economy? And sort of how has that developed over the last several years?
Money, you said?
And the role of the market.
Market.
To allocate resources both in the consumer sector and the business sector.
Thank you. One of the results of these reforms that I have tried to explain here is that the proportion of people employed by the state has been going lower, despite all these obstacles to economic reforms. It's about, I give the figures in the papers, but I think that people employed by the state has moved from 100% 20 years ago to 85% officially acknowledged by the Cuban government. And I think your question is very interesting because there is, of course, a close link between who employs you and what your political preferences are. And that's one of the risks that the Cuban government is running now. I mean, all these people fired probably will find a way of living in the market economy, but if they do, they will lose loyalty to the government. Last time I went to Cuba in 2006, I found a lot of cynicism among people. They were very critical. They had a discourse of boring of the political system. Some youngsters still believe in the systems, but some others didn't. And they were very clear in stating that. So I could say that this variable will be very interesting. I mean, Cuba could manage a transition to a Chinese-style economy if this tension between keeping political fidelity and creating new sources of income does not implode or explode in the role. So that would be a very interesting variable to watch. On the other side, I mean, remittances from Cubans in Miami were legalized in the 90s in order to get more foreign currency. So probably one cleavage now in Cuban society is who has and who has not relatives in Miami. So who gets foreign exchange and who doesn't. And so many of these new businesses probably will use these remittances from families in the United States. Cuban families, Cuban relatives in the United States. And so I found Cubans to be very interested in getting foreign currencies because if you get dollars or euros, you can buy whatever you want in Cuba. I mean, your money is magical because of the exchange rate. So I would say that it's very important, but I would say that this closeness to the United States and this possibility of having US dollars or euros has changed the mindset of many people in Cuba.
Okay. Question right here in the front.
You've described how North Korea has been very reluctant to embrace tourism And you've described how Cuba, on the other hand, you know, has been very quick to embrace it. North Korea is well known for being an isolationist country, and I guess it wouldn't really, it kind of would shatter the idea of it being a worker's paradise if lots of tourists come in with iPads and iPhones. Why, on the other hand, has Cuba not seen this or feared this dynamic of tourists coming of much more affluent societies? Why is Cuba not, you know, scared of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think they've been quite pragmatic on this. For Cuba, it's more important to have these foreign investments, because having these foreign investments, you increase productivity, you employ people, but you don't have like native entrepreneurial groups. I wonder if you understand. I mean, you don't have to deal with Cuban businessmen inside Cuba. So it's very easy for the Cuban government to make arrangements with these multinational companies, and that's it. So I would say that they're very pragmatic. They, of course, they are worried about having some kind of contagion and ideological imitation of Western tourists, but they run the risk. And the outcome has been that many Cuban girls have left the country, married to either British or German or Canadian or Mexican tourists. So it's been a... But at the same time, these people send money to Cuba. So I think it's a calculated risk. I think there is a lot of contacts between Cubans and foreigners. But so far, it hasn't... This process hasn't led to the... to a loss of legitimacy of the regime, at least in a visible way. So I guess it's a risk that the Cuban government decided to run. And so it's the explanation of the different performance of Cuba vis-a-vis North Korea. Mm-hmm.
Okay, question in the back, yes.
It's Charlie Wong from Kroll & Moreng. Do your estimates of the DPRK economy include the various illicit activities that the the North Koreans are probably engaging in, such as counterfeiting, narco trafficking, illegal arms sales? And there's no way to estimate that. And also, second point is that isn't that a structural reason why it would be very difficult to liberalize the economy in any way, because with liberalization would come increased scrutiny of those very profitable illegal activities?
Yeah, of course, as far as they are illegal, it's very difficult to estimate them. There are some estimates made mostly by American scholars on this parallel economy, called the economy two. Probably one means of financing current account deficit for North Korea has to do with this kind of illegal activities. But of course, these estimates don't include them. But should be very powerful. I mean, there are lots of incidents of North Korean diplomats caught selling methamphetamines or drugs in third countries. And so should be, or the sale of missiles to Middle East countries or whatever. So it should be an important part of the economy, but obviously it's not like included in these estimates, the same way as drug trafficking is not included officially in Mexican or Colombian balance of payments account. So, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist, of course.
Okay.
To what extent, we don't know. I mean, there are many things that we don't know about North Korea.
All right. First, I want to thank everyone for joining us here today. So we have a great paper and a good discussion on the economic reforms and the comparisons between North Korea and Cuba. Our next academic paper series will be on May 25th with Dr. Young Kwon Song. He's comparing the CORUS FTA and the Korea-EU FTA. So hope you join us for that. And now would you please join me in thanking Dr. Jose Luis Leon Manriquez.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your questions.